I am a human being and I killed human beings.
Before I knew it, I'd fired 4 shots at the door. I kept on shouting for Reva to phone the police.
Tests are underway to determine if a serial killer is on the loose in Centurion, Pretoria.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
In a country marked by the harsh reality of 75 daily murders, these are the stories that echo through the reality of life in South Africa. Hello, I'm Paul Llewellyn, and I'm delving into the minds of Africa's most evil. What drives them to commit unspeakable acts, and what does it take to bring them to justice? Leading the way and typing over there on our journey is Gerard Labuschagne, an author, former law enforcement officer and current head of LNS Threat Management. Labuschagne helmed the investigative psychology section of the South African Police Service from 2001 to 2016, working on over 300 cases of serial murder and rape. He is an internationally recognized and renowned expert in forensic psychology, who's extremely fast at grabbing a ringing cell phone and is simply known as the Profiler. Please spread the word about the podcast. Share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone interested in crime in Africa. We are back recording more episodes. Visit us at youtube.com/C/ProfilerAfrica. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Just search Profiler Africa. You can follow us on Instagram at Profiler Africa and join our Facebook group, or drop us an email at profilerafricainfo@gmail.com. If you have, I will be getting to a backlog of emails and messages on the social media pages. Get ready to explore crime scenes, sift through evidence pics, and confront images of perpetrators and victims, all as we help to enhance your understanding of the topics we talk about. So, Gerard, hi, how are you? 2024.
Can't believe it's 2024. Yes, it has been a while. That is very, very true.
Yeah, almost the end of January 2023.
We jumped into 2023 with good intentions. I had good intentions with the podcast, and it all kind of just got a bit hectic in 2023, unfortunately. But we're back. And we're back and we're recording new episodes, and let's see where it takes us. Gerard, what's going on in your life, in the world of law and order?
So interesting is that I'm still consulting to corporates, helping them deal with when there's threats towards the safety of their employees from external sources or internal people from in the company, and how do they manage behavior that causes them concern. But I've been doing a lot of interesting court cases. So during last year, I was involved to some degree in the Gerry Ackerman case, the guy who was convicted of raping minor children and running a minor sex massage parlor, et cetera, along with his co-accused Paul Kennedy, advocate Paul Kennedy, who committed suicide prior to the case going to trial. Currently busy with lawyers for human rights, with the rights relating to a particular offender. What else? I have a case involving one of these sort of big charismatic church pastors that I'm assisting the prosecution with. So a lot of interesting cases that have been coming up in the past year that I've been involved in from a criminal case point of view.
First of all, sound like some interesting stuff that we can chat about. Mm-hmm. The state of, I see the crime statistics, nothing seems to be improving too vastly. In fact, things seem to be kind of declining continually. What is your take on the current state of kind of the nation?
From a crime point of view, it's not particularly surprising. I mean, if you look at the crime stats, they've been creeping up for the past 10 years. Hmm. Well, say, particularly the murder stats. Let me rather talk about that. So from 2011, 2012 financial year, it was about 15,500 plus minus. And last year, 22-23 financial year, it's up to 27,000. So that's like a 50-something percent increase in the past 10 years. So now there was a decrease even from about 94. There was a significant decrease.
To around 2012.
Yeah, so and then it kind of just picked up again. So I think it's, again, it's a couple of things. Murder isn't one thing, so there'll be different reasons why people are killing people. But again, having not a particularly effective policing and ability to investigate, arrest the right person, prepare a docket for court, give the prosecutor a winnable case, competent prosecutors to lead that case in court, that's definitely not helpful to making sure people reconsider ever trying to kill someone. So the less people think they're going to get caught for any crime, whether it's jaywalking to tax evasion to assault, robbery, theft, housebreaking, the less you think you're going to get caught, then what really are the consequences for your action? It makes it easier for people to engage. I mean, then you got the socioeconomic stuff, and of course, you know, we were downgraded from on whatever one of those listings were. We have our own state capture issues, etc. I don't want to get too much into politics. So, you know, all these put pressure on people to commit, on the one side, economic crimes, and of course, we have the good old-fashioned interpersonal types of crimes that would happen even if you're a billionaire.
And it doesn't feel like the government has really done anything to acknowledge the fact that there's a need for a real focused response, you know, to tackle the problem.
Yeah, I can't say that I've really seen things coming from government, and perhaps specifically the police, even the NPA, that make me think, okay, we've turned the corner. Those are the right words we want to hear. Now let's just put it into action and get it going. You know, so I don't like to be bleak. I don't want to live in any other country than this one. My family's been in this country for over 300 years. So it's just not, you have to be realistic that we're not hearing, the kind of words that you want to hear.
You know, to put it in perspective, at its lowest level in 2012, the murder rate was at 29.5 per 100,000, and we're up to 75
per 100,000.
Per 100,000. So, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, in the last decade, that's a, you know, it's mega. It's substantial. It's worrying. But we'll unpack more of that as we chat. And, you know, I guess it's always been a common theme and it will continue to be. Of course, the one aspect that, the one aspect of law enforcement which enhances, you know, our ability to effectively fight crime is a sense that there's suitable punishment at the end of the day, and that punishment will be enforced and that justice will be done. And this leads us on to, nice segue, Paul, this leads us on to the discussion for today. And we're really going to be talking about the parole system, and kind of there have been some very, very high profile parolees lately. And so that's going to be the focus of our discussion. I'm sure that the folks out there listening are well aware of the fact that Oscar is back amongst us, and we'll discuss the Oscar case. Also a worrying one, which I'm very keen to hear your perspective on, is the Station Strangler being released, and we'll also touch a bit on the Moodley case, but generally just have a general discussion about the state of parole and maybe kind of open people's eyes a little bit to some of the realities of how our parole system works, how sentencing works, and how it is that we're seeing some very strange characters being released back onto the streets, which, like I say, the Station Strangler, for example, I don't know. I wouldn't be resting easy if I had kids in the hood of the Station Strangler. In South Africa, parole is administered by the Department of Correctional Services, and it's a form of conditional release granted to inmates who have served a portion of their sentence and who have demonstrated good behavior and rehabilitation. Let's kick off, shall we, with the Oscar case, I think being the most current and most kind of talked about in the press locally and internationally. Give us a little bit of a lowdown on where we stand with the Oscar case and how we got to where we got to today.
So for those of you that might not recall the history of Oscar Pistorius, the morning, I think, of Valentine's Day, 2013, he ended up shooting his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, who was a sort of entry-level model and sort of getting to the reality show kind of market, a very, very lovely young lady who qualified at LLB. And, of course, that got him arrested. And then, of course, we had this long, lengthy trial, etc., where lots of ups and downs. It's all on YouTube if you ever want to watch the first ever televised trial in South Africa from start to finish. Mm-hmm. And long story short, he was found first guilty of, I think, culpable homicide, which is like the negligent killing of someone else. And there was like the careless, you were careless, and someone then lost their lives. The prosecution appealed that. And long story short, eventually, after a few more appeal processes, he was convicted of murder and given a sentence which in total amounted to 15 years. Taking into consideration that he already served sort of 1 year, 7 months by the time the appeal on his sentence went through. So fast forward, and I think November last year, the correctional services, after a bugger up about 6 months earlier when they miscalculated his parole review date, eventually had a parole hearing, I think in November last year, 2023, and then agreed that he should be released on parole. So 5th of January, 2024, Oscar was released on parole. Now, I mean, the Oscar story itself, you still, if you speak to anybody and take a poll, you'll have people who 100% believe he shouldn't have gone to jail, and people who 100% believe he should go to jail, he should have gone to jail. That's a very kind of polarizing discussion and argument for anybody that has some kind of insights into it. Now, I think the whole argument about whether, you know, how long should someone sit in jail if they do kill someone, should they ever get released, that's kind of like a separate argument. The reality is we kind of have to work with what we've got, which is that everybody, even someone who was sentenced to life imprisonment, will come up for parole at a certain point in their sort of period of being sentenced.
Yes. So the first thing people need to understand is there is no such thing as life without parole.
Nope.
In South Africa. You will always come up for parole. How did you assess the public response to Oscar being released? Because it seemed, you know, I mean, it seemed to kind of pass us by over the December holidays quite, and yes, it made the newspapers, but I didn't get a sense that there was much, you know, apart, I'm sure, from kind of Reva's family and friends and kind of immediate circles, that there was a huge amount of kind of concern about it from a public point of view.
You know, I think it invigorated some interest, but you know, if you think back, or if you can remember back to the amount of interest that generated during the trial, I mean, you had a packed courtroom every single day with an overflow courtroom next door, the international media outside. It was a circus. You had the 24-hour Oscar channel on, you know, pop-up channel on whatever DSTV or whatever it was, and I mean, it was insane, the amount of coverage. So definitely not the level of coverage that you got back then. You know, the media did cover it when the correctional services bungled up the date earlier, they covered it, and then of course in November it was covered, and there was a little bit of immediate tension on the day he was released on the 5th of January. I think maybe that was intentional. 5th of January, everybody's still on holiday, so I don't think people care that much that they're going to get their holiday time to go sit and exactly. Stare and wait to see if they can get a glimpse of Oscar entering his uncle's home in Pretoria. So maybe that was strategic.
Metric results are the priority around that.
Yeah, you know, recovering from the 1st of January and stuff like that. So,
you know, the one thing we have the opportunity to do with this discussion is kind of pick your brain and to kind of get your unique insight, because people at home may not realize, or people listening may not realize, that you were very, very much involved in the case from day one. On the morning that it happened, I mean, you can tell the story, but you were headed off to court. Your court date was your court hearing or appearance was cancelled or postponed, and you turned around and headed to Oscar's house. Tell us a little bit about your involvement, just so that folks can kind of contextualize or understand, you know, once we get into some of your opinions around Oscar, kind of your background with the case personally.
Yeah, so as you said, you know, I was off to go testify in a case in Soweto. On the way there, I'd already heard early in the morning that Oscar shot his girlfriend, but because the body was no longer at the scene, I thought I wasn't going to go out to the scene. And as you said, I had to go off to be in Soweto. So I had to leave Pretoria with traffic issues quite early. And then that was cancelled when I was on the way there. And then, of course, it was all over the media, you know, and the speculation. Was it a mistaken identity? Was it a crime of passion? And then I thought, you know, clearly, if they are going to charge him for a crime, well, he's either going to have to plead guilty or not guilty. And if he's going to plead not guilty, it's going to have to be something of mistaken identity, which was already some of the things we were hearing, or maybe temporary insanity, as you kind of the American terminology. So I decided that it's a good idea then for me to see if I can at least spend time in his presence. So that wasn't there to be doing a formal interview, because already his lawyers were involved. So I contacted the station commissioner. I said, look, this is who I am. And this is my reasons. And he said, yes, that's fine. So I headed out there and I asked my colleague, Jan de Lange, who we did a podcast interview with last year, to meet me at the police station, and we'll strategize. And then we met there, and I sent Yanni off to the crime scene to see what's happening there. And I then basically essentially spent time with Oscar, accompanied him to the Mamelodi East Clinic where he did his medical evaluation, the J88, where they just kind of check for any injuries on the person, and just really just hanged out with him, if you want to put it that way, in the car at the hospital for about, in total, about 3 hours. So I didn't ask him what happened. I didn't interview. I wasn't doing a formal assessment. It was really just getting a sense of, do I pick up anything strange that later might be relevant, you know, exactly, in terms of his criminal capacity? It's not there to try and nail him. It's with, am I picking up anything by having first-hand interaction with him? Because any expert that his defense lawyers would get involved would be interviewing Oscar months down the line, after he's been, you know, in consultations with lawyers and the full case facts. So you don't know how that assessment might be. Would it be a very accurate reflection of the date? So at least I would be able to say, well, I saw him within, you know, 3 hours, 4 hours of the incident.
As well as some of your colleagues also being kind of around and about.
Yeah.
Psychologists, I mean.
Yeah. So that was kind of the logic. And that's really at that point all I did. Until, of course, we neared the trial. There was a trial date. They had decided to prosecute him. Harinel was involved. I went to see him. I said, this is the situation. And then I was asked to spend quite a bit of time in court, along with a couple other people, sort of as an advisory panel to Harinel. So you'll sometimes, if you look at the YouTube video, see me sitting there. You'll see the crime scene guy is permanently there, Benny. You see Colonel Fonanes sitting there. You'll see a bunch of us that kind of have different expertise within the police that were there. Because, of course, we eventually also don't know what the defense was going to be calling and presenting as evidence in court, because they don't have to give us their evidence beforehand. The state, the prosecution, has to hand over all of its evidence prior to the start of the trial to the defense.
Having a podcast called Profiler, and you being a profiler, gives us the unique ability to go to ask the question, Jared, how could you give us a little bit of a profile of Oscar in your opinion? I mean, I understand that it's kind of from your point of view, and listeners must understand that it's kind of based upon your personal insights and your expertise and experience. You know, if you were to evaluate Oscar, and we'll get towards whether or not we think he should, we'll get to whether or not we think he should be out currently, based on kind of his psychological profile. Can you give us a bit of a psychological profile of Oscar? Can you do that?
Well, technically, no.
Yeah, that's why. Just explain.
So the Health Professions Council's regulations or ethical code says, you know, you can't assess someone. There's very rare circumstances where you can assess someone without their consent, and of course then give an opinion about someone psychologically without their consent. And that's kind of, you know, that people don't start making diagnoses about politicians and, you know, people that, you know, you had no direct access to, and of course had no grounds to.
Then what are some of the kind of interesting themes, if you were to do a profile of Oscar, that might come out there that you would focus on, and some of the aspects of his personality that you would maybe hone in on?
So I mean, I think it's fairly safe to comment. I'm not going to make any, like you said, diagnostic formulations, and I'm not even saying that there is necessary any diagnostic formulations. But I think the things that I often wondered about is, you know, you have this history of being quite reckless with firearms. Mm-hmm. So was this just another example of that recklessness? You know, for those of you that perhaps aren't familiar with the trial, in the trial he wasn't just charged with the shooting of Reva. There was the shot that went off in Tasha's restaurant on, like, I think it was a Saturday morning, a weekend morning in the busy crowd at Tasha's restaurant at Melrose Arch, when he took someone else's gun under the table because he wanted to see it, and boom, shot went off. There was the alleged shooting out of the sunroof, you know. So there's quite a few incidences where he was perhaps not the most careful with firearms as we would like someone to be who's a legal firearm owner. You know, you do often wonder, you know, he's suddenly dating a supermodel. Well, I mean, she wasn't perhaps a supermodel, but she was a very, very attractive young lady starting on a modeling career. I think for most guys, you know, that is quite anxiety provoking, you know, to be dating someone who's incredibly beautiful. That gets a lot of attention. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's difficult for anybody. And, you know, did Oscar have the same dating kind of experience that many other people did? You know, each relationship teaches you about yourself, about relationships, and you learn from that. So those are the kinds of things that I was worrying about. And of course, you know, I think to be an Olympic athlete, you have to be very determined, and determined to the point where you're selfish. It's because you have to, you know, you have to put aside your personal life, your interests, because you want to get to a certain level of success. You want to become an Olympic athlete. You want to win, you know, in whatever sport you're participating in. So in a way, you become very selfish. So I'm not saying that's a personality issue with Oscar. I'm just saying That's a level of determination to become a top-class professional athlete. And did that, you know, come into his relationships? We saw with some WhatsApps with Reva, you know, that she said, you know, but you can do this and it's okay, but if I do something similar, I get into trouble. So, you know, does that kind of self-centered focusedness, did that play out in some way?
You know, and the pressures of kind of international fame and all of the kind of everything that comes along with that, you know, that obviously has a big impact on the ego and kind of your view of yourself in the world. It, you know, you must have an elevated view of your kind of your importance in the world if everyone for years is telling you how how important you are. A symbol, especially, you know, I mean, he was a iconic in the in the kind of Paralympic kind of context.
Yeah, and I mean, he was someone I think that before the shooting, almost most South Africans, you know, that knew him just as this, the athlete. You know, he was a hero. He was one of our success stories. You know, he was something we could all be proud of. You know, we all saw him as this lovable guy. You know, great, kind person. You know, that would help other little kids. You know, who were also double amputees and. You know, and there were a lot of nice stories that came out, you know, about him in that time period. So I think we loved him, and perhaps that was part of the problem. We kind of, you know, people tended to excuse behavior that perhaps on retrospect, you know, that we kind of thought that was perhaps something we should
have. Well, this is like the paradox of fame, isn't it? I mean, we're introduced to a character through his media presence, or to a person, whether it be a man or a woman, through their media presence and what it is that they do out in the world. But we're not exposed to, you know, the realities of what they're like in their personal and private lives. So it's interesting because, you know, in the context of the whole case and thinking about his parole now, it is a lot to overcome all of that positive sentiment, you know, and I'm sure it was a big factor in just in how the case rolled out is the fact that, you know, there's so much public opinion in favor of Oscar. It's difficult just to accept that this guy that you've been told for years is such a great role model and such a wonderful person, is potentially just a just a cold-blooded killer.
And I saw an expression the other day that the second part of it was, your opinion forms your facts.
Yeah.
So I think if you saw him as this really great guy and he's you're a fan of his, you're perhaps going to be more inclined to interpret anything as yes, but to kind of keep maintain that, you know, he's, you know, poor guy. This maybe was a genuine accident, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas if you didn't, if you maybe had a neutral attitude and you're kind of hearing about the case, you might be more inclined to see the information without some kind of a bias. And we all have biases. There's nothing wrong with that. So
now, as far as his parole is concerned, now you'll serve a certain portion of a prison sentence, or you'll be serving your prison sentence, whatever that may be, up to 25 years, which is a life sentence. And then at some point, the correctional services are not obliged to let you out on parole. There is an obligation. You do have the right to parole hearings starting at a certain point. What is it that initiates that discussion? How did we initially go from, okay, Oscar's now locked away, to, okay, he's now crossed the line. What line is he crossing to qualify for parole? Understand, you know, what is the eligibility assessment at stage one?
So I think we have to first quickly touch on how do sentences work.
Fine.
So you'll have a person who's convicted of, say, a robbery in the same trial, a theft, and something more minor, I don't know, malicious damage to property.
Sure.
So he might get 15 years for the robbery, 5 years for the theft, 2 years for the malicious damage to property. So if you add them all up, 23? Sorry, my math is terrible. Okay. You're not getting 23 years term. So that's why when people in the media present sentences, oh, he got 50 years sentence, 100 years sentence. That's not the length of his sentence. That's if you add up all the little sentences. They all start basically, typically, on day one. When you get given those the 15, the 10, and the 3 on that day in court, they all start ticking down at that moment in time. So it's only the longest one that really affects when you're going to get parole. So you'd be working in my scenario now on the 15 years. So you'd calculate your parole period based on that 15 years, because you would have served the 2, the 3-year, and the 5-year other little sentences before you were eligible for parole on the bigger length of sentence. That's the first thing you have to understand. Life sentences work a little bit differently. So the normal rule now is that halfway through that sentence, you would start to have parole hearings. So like you quite rightly said, parole is not a right, it's a privilege, but you do have the right, according to the Act, to have hearings where you will be considered for parole, and there's a process that we will get into in a moment. For life sentences, it's a little bit different. Currently, right now, if you get a life sentence, it is till the day you die, you will always have the life sentence. But at 25 years, you will have your first parole hearing. If you don't get a parole, you'll, you know, it's another 2 years that you have to wait, another 2 years, another 2 years. If you never get parole, you very likely could die in prison as an old man. If you do get parole, like most people will at some point, even on a life sentence, then you will be serving the remainder of your sentence in the community with certain conditions of your, on your behavior. So parole itself is not a bad thing. I mean, people often like, oh, you know, you're just letting people out. I think it's a very important thing. I don't necessarily agree halfway through your sentence, but I do think in a year or two, at least, of your sentence expiring in its entirety, that you are released back into the community. Firstly, you have to show that you have someone who's prepared to take you in, like typically a family member or a friend.
Okay, Oscar's not struggling on that one.
No, definitely not. Okay. So, because they can't just release you to nowhere. Yeah. Right, so someone's going to take responsibility. Then you're going to have conditions like you have to be at home at 5 o'clock every day, you can't leave the house until 6 in the morning, not allowed to drink, not allowed to associate with gang members, not allowed, of course, commit crime. You can only go to work and back or church on the weekend. You know, there'll be conditions that the correctional services will impose upon you. They will check upon you. You'll have to check in with them. There'll be spot checks, ideally. Whether this happens is, again, a separate issue. You might have to participate in further programs, counseling, etc. And that's basically like testing you out to see if you're going to cope back in society. And if you don't, we can pull you back in and perhaps give you whatever else support we need back inside the prison. So that's why.
And if you're on a life sentence, they could pull you in indefinitely.
Well, again, it'll depend on the seriousness of the transgression. So if you maybe miss one appointment, or you get home 10 minutes later than you should have, and they find that out, they're probably not going to withdraw your parole.
But if you beat up your girlfriend.
Yeah, I think you probably get arrested for another crime. Potentially, yeah. That's a good reason. You know, you just disappear.
Okay.
Those will be good. And then, of course, you'll be back in prison, and then at some point you'll be considered again. So it's not as if you lose it and that's it and it's gone forever.
No.
So that's kind of how parole works. You know, I do have a bit of a problem that currently for a non-life sentence halfway through, because correctional services almost seems to be of the opinion that you should be released when we reach that minimum detention period, which, like I said, is halfway through. They almost seem to think, well, you should be released unless there's something really bad that's keeping you in. And I'm sorry, I don't think that's actually how it should work, and I don't think that's what the court intends. So my personal view is, I think we should have it, you should serve at least 2/3,
yeah.
You know, and only within like 2 or 3 years of you being finishing your sentence should you then be on that test period given parole. But of course, I mean, I can say what I want, the law is the law.
So you should be kept in indefinitely unless there's a really great reason to let you out.
Yeah,
you've proven a great reason to let you out.
Yeah, so, you know, again, what would that be? You've done whatever courses they say you should do. You've proven yourself not to be a troublemaker in the prison. You've improved yourself. You have a goal. You've, again, feel some sense of remorse, at least not even remorse, but responsibility for what you've done. Mm-hmm. But like I said, the parole boards, maybe because they're just trying to get people out because the prisons are full, kind of just
seem quite happy. Well, that was
going to
be a question that was coming up. Let's discuss the context of the state of correctional services and what other factors outside of just the elements of a particular case might be at play here. Things like overpopulation in prisons and wanting to get people out of prison. Perhaps even things like, you know, someone like Oscar is a strain on the PR resources, and when he's out of jail, we don't have to worry about him. You know, we don't have to be concerned about navigating any Oscar discussions. I don't know.
Mm.
What is your assessment of some of the other factors that might be motivating correctional services to have the perspective that as you've just laid it out, where you know.
So I think, yeah, definitely, I think they would probably, I don't think it's an official policy, but I do think they would take overcrowding into consideration. Yeah. I mean, you're naive if you don't think corruption's at play here.
Well, what are we talking about? You're buying your way out of prison.
You know, I always say, and I've said this many times, that we don't doubt that a policeman could be corrupt, right? That a policeman who's investigating a case against you, that people might be able to, not every cop, but I mean that is a realistic concern, that a suspect could bribe a cop to fudge the investigation, lose the docket, etc. We don't have I don't think anybody in South Africa has the belief that that would never happen. I think even prosecutors, you know, there have been stories of prosecutors who've been taking money to not prosecute or to fudge the case, etc. So I don't think many of us doubt that that is a realistic concern.
Yeah.
But even, you know, fortunately, magistrates and potentially judges, you know, I don't think we feel that's beyond the realm of possibility that a judge or magistrate could be influenced to fudge a case.
Yeah.
So why is it that we don't think that the people who can release you halfway through your sentence, that there could be corruption there?
Yeah.
And then what mechanisms is there? I mean, my opinion, we should have lifestyle audits on every parole board member.
Yeah.
We should have polygraphs of parole board members.
Yeah.
We should at least, if anything, have review of parole board's performance. So let's say the Johannesburg one, you know, out of the 10% of the people you release reoffend. Okay, but maybe the Pretoria one and the Cape Town one is 2%. Okay, why is the Joburg one so bad?
Absolutely.
Is it because they ignore what the experts are telling them? Is it because it looks like they just made a very bad decision, which could be incompetence or corruption? You know, and then, so we're not doing those kind of research to say, but hang on, these guys are going to reoffend. Let's go back to the parole board and see what they said and what was the things that were raised there. Because again, you know, maybe they're making just bad decisions and we need to change that parole board to give them further training or whatever. Mm. But also, I also feel that there should be consequences.
Well, absolutely. What is the typical makeup of a parole board?
So, this is kind of, and again, I often think I understand this, then I look at it again and I think I don't understand this. You can go to the Correctional Services Act of 1998, which is on, if you Google it, it's on the internet. I'm looking at it right now on my computer, which discusses a whole bunch of stuff in relation to prisoners or offenders, including parole. I think if you go to Section 42, they talk about a case management committee. Now, that's the first kind of group of people who are responsible for deciding, when I get into prison, where am I going? What do I need? What rehabilitation? But they're also the people, the CMC, that does, for example, do an assessment, like the psychologist who's part of that CMC would do a parole assessment. The social worker would do a parole assessment. The head of that person's unit in the prison would give a report about that offender. They then kind of make their own recommendations about yes or no for parole. That information is then handed over to the parole board. So the CMC part of it does consist of professionals. All right, psychologists, social workers, people perhaps who really have more indirect interaction with the offender but also have directly assessed the offender. But then the parole board is something that the minister appoints. And essentially it consists of a chairperson, vice chairperson, one member of SAPS nominated by the national commissioner. I'm just looking at this list now. An official of the Department of Justice or an alternate with a legal background. Two officials of the department nominated by the commissioner, in other words, Department of Correctional Services, two members of the community. So there aren't actually professionals sitting on the parole board.
Hmm.
So in that parole committee...
It's like a jury.
When the parole board gets that, you have a non-psychologist looking at a report. My concern is, do they understand what that report says?
Hmm.
You also have non-experts who then, if they decide that the person shouldn't get parole, that make referrals back to the psychologist saying, you need to give him therapy for this. But as I often have said, it's like me, who's a psychologist, telling an orthopedic surgeon, listen, you should do an arthroscopy replacement of this person's leg. Like, on what makes me qualified to do that? So I've heard, and I speak to a lot of my colleagues who are correctional services psychologists, bless their hearts, who say we get the most weird referrals back from the parole board. The love of money, that was the one for Donovan Williams. You must do therapy for this offender because it was love of money.
Okay.
And I sat there in that parole board thinking, I have no idea how you got to that view that he has love of money, firstly. And I can imagine psychologists going, WTF.
No, exactly. What are we going to do? Send him up a monastery for 6 months
or something? So you get inane referrals back because the people sitting in this parole board are not experts. You should have another psychologist sitting there who has the ability to say, this is a bad report. Firstly,
now just a broader contextual question again, just as we carry on, the parole board, do they work for correctional services? So is it a department of What's the joint link there, or is it independent?
So it's kind of independent. So you'll find that some of the people, as you look on this, it's Section 74 of the Correctional Services Act. You know, it'll say that a chairperson and vice chair doesn't state that they have to be. Those are appointed by the minister. So I don't think those are correctional service employees.
Could that be anyone?
It could be anyone. I think you actually nominate yourself to serve on these boards.
Oh, okay.
The SAPS member is just, it's not the, like the detective of that case. It's just a SAPS member who sits there.
Sure.
And the other people are not. So there are one or two people who might be DCS employees, and then the rest, I think, as far as I understand this, are external people.
You know, it so doesn't you might get a sound like you've got a lot of, you necessarily kind of got a
skill set at all.
a group of people who are really, really going to be historically up to speed with everything and
on,
anything there is to know about this case.
And
or the particular case that they're looking
at. Oh, no.
And obviously the general issues that you need to have a command of in order to be capable to do this.
You have to remember that when you're convicted, it's not like a copy of your case file for your police docket goes to correctional services.
Yeah.
It's not even that the copy of the judgment from the court which summarizes what you've done, or even the sentences, the sentence judgment. None of that necessarily, in fact, that doesn't go to court. I can almost say to you now, like maybe 1%, some of that might end up in the court.
So for the listener to understand, when you go, if you get charged and sent to prison, you are not, the correctional services does not have a docket with all of the details of your case outlining. So you go there as just another prisoner with a 25-year sentence and you start.
They'll know that you're convicted of murder and robbery. The murder you got, the life sentence, the robbery you got 15 years.
And this is an interesting component, isn't it? Because then you do things like, if you think about all of the murderers that were caught in the 90s, the early 2000s, who are coming up for parole now, with the brain drain that we've discussed on a regular basis out of the police service, you know, there's not a lot of continuity, surely. So somebody who is, you know, the guy that worked on the Stuart Vilken case is no longer an active serving police officer and is not going to be roped into a parole hearing unless that person volunteers and goes out of their way to get there. It's not necessary. So there's a loss of institutional knowledge. There's a loss of knowledge as to
why
the guy's there in the first place.
From the Donovan Moodley case, in the most recent hearing, we'll get into the details in a short while about that case, which was last year. Captain Mike Van Aert, who's now Colonel Mike Van Aert, who was involved in the Donovan Moodley investigation along with Pete Bielefeld, because he was on Pete Bielefeld's team, was actually told by the parole board chairperson, after Donovan Moodley objected his presence, was told that he had to leave.
Sure.
So in the old days, I mean, when does the old days stop and end? You were supposed to submit, when the person was convicted and sentenced, the policeman was supposed to submit an SAP 62, which is where he would literally, by hand or type with an old-fashioned typewriter, whatever he wants to say about this case. This case was the worst case I ever worked on. The judge says this, blah, blah, blah. This is exactly, in other words, you could give some detail, and that SAP 62 would go with the person to prison. Now, along with that, the policeman could attach, if he had, by some miracle, a typed judgment. He could attach that to the SAP 62. If he had a report by a psychologist at sentencing, he could attach that. If he had newspaper clippings, he could attach that.
Okay.
And that would go into his file. Okay. But I can guarantee you now, almost nobody submits anything on the SAP 62. So literally, they get a person who, I don't know what you did. Now, you can get an offender who brutally murdered and raped a woman, but what does he tell his therapist in correctional services? Yes, I did rape this woman. He doesn't go into the fact that he tortured her. Yeah,
exactly.
He can spin a softened version of what happens. And how would you know? And that's kind of in the Moodley case. He kind of twisted the versions of events. And that can be proven if you look at the documentation that he compiled and the judge's
And so
sentence.
Time is his friend, really, because, you know, the story changes over time. There's not a lot of continuity to kind of keep everyone up to speed with what the real facts are with regard to the case. I know that you've stayed close to that case, and there have been occasions when you've tried to keep in the loop, but parole hearings have popped up, and you've only found out about it the afternoon before. Yeah. Same for the family, where they're trying to stay on top of the, as is their right, to be involved in the parole process.
Yeah.
But it's almost like they try to kind of get one over on them and sneak a parole hearing through here and there. And am I right?
The Lee Matthews example is a very good one. So the Matthews family, we're talking like 3-4 years ago, said to me, look, Gerard, you know, we don't know, that we meaning Rob Matthews and his wife Sharon, the parents of Lee, we don't know if we're going to be alive, because at that point, Donovan Woodley was only supposed to have a parole hearing in 2029.
Okay.
There was one or two, and this is perhaps getting a bit more detailed, one or two court judgments which, depending when you were convicted to a life or sentenced to a life sentence, because there was a change from 20 years to 25 years for the parole date, there was a small select group of people which actually brought their parole dates forward, like in Donovan Woodley's case, from 2029 to 2019, 10 years earlier. So the Matthews family wasn't aware of that. So they were still thinking, but you know, 2029, we're not sure, you know, we're getting on in age. We want to make sure that some representations are on record. And they asked me, would I be prepared to write a report? And they were going to prepare statements. And they'd been in contact with correctional services saying, we want to, if it ever comes up, we want to submit documentation. And then all of a sudden we find out, hey, actually, no, he's one of the people whose parole dates are brought forward 10 years. And actually, you know, he's having a hearing very shortly. So they actually even had an initial hearing until the policeman who was on that parole board said, whoa, we need to look into this case more in more detail, and stopped it, thankfully. Okay. And then we realized, but hang on, that almost, you can almost be, if you want to be very paranoid, say they snuck one through. Yeah. So the Matthews family went back to correctional services and said, but we were in communication with you. It's not like you don't know where we are and how you're and you snuck, try to sneak one through. So then you get things like that, which, again, you can either say is it incompetence or conspiracy. It's, you know, I don't know which one it is.
The bottom line is, though, can you imagine what it's like for just for anyone that's trying to just keep in the loop as to, you know, obviously this is a family that is very much staying on top of wanting to be involved and wanting to be knowledgeable on what steps are occurring, you know, with regards to his incarceration. So what about the poor
Gogo from, you know, an informal settlement in Limpopo, you know, who doesn't even have email?
Yeah.
So because you are allowed to give representations as the family members or the victim, if your victim's still alive, you're allowed to give representations at the parole hearing. You're allowed to be present to say your say. Mm. So now I can guarantee you now 90% of these the poor family members.
Yeah.
I mean, how would they know the dates? They don't necessarily know the dates. Who do they contact?
Yeah.
It's a real difficult thing. So I personally think there should be, amongst the other changes, a website, correctional services hosted website, where you can say, right, offender so-and-so, log in. You get a personal login details. These are my contact details. Please make sure that you contact me. Yeah. So they can then check, okay, great. Mr. Mlangeni signed up for this particular case. Here's his email or his phone number. I'm going to phone him and say, sir, the person that you've registered is coming up for parole in a year's time. We're going to have the hearing in 6 months' time. Or you can upload a document, a little affidavit of what you'd like to have said if you think you're not going to necessarily be around. That's one easy
Sounds
way.
Sounds like there's a hole to fill with an user-friendly app that everyone can access and that can just kind of help to keep that connection between those people who are
wanting to stay involved, linked
to the case, wanting to stay involved, and correctional services and the parole boards. Mm. Just an interesting case that came up, and it kind of covers a few things we've discussed, is a story that came up while we were filming some of the TV stuff was down in Cape Town, a policeman who'd been killed in the early 2000s. There was a bank robbery, about 5 or 6 bank robbers, and the policeman and his partner had picked the kind of right route that they were going to take as the cops were kind of reacting to the reports of the break-in, pulled this car over and was killed. I think about 5 of the suspects were arrested. They were all charged and sentenced to a life term for murder. Mm. Okay. I mean, I don't have the detail is not 1,000, but this is the basics of it. So sentenced to life. Then recently, a year or two ago, when we were doing the interview, the daughter was explaining to us that, you know, they'd been correctional services had reached out to them for them to be involved in the what do they call it, the victim?
Yeah, you get part of that process, the victim offender dialogue,
the
hearing where they get to talk to each other. That's kind of aimed at sort of reconciliation. Then you can still be at the actual hearing itself.
So they'd been invited and they participated in that because they were of the feeling that the more you are involved, the more likelihood that there is that these people will stay locked up for a longer period. And so they were like, okay, so these two guys are coming up for parole. What about the others? And the other three had vanished out of the system. Correctional services didn't know where they were. We spoke to the National Prosecuting Authority. Well, we it's very hard to get communication from correctional services, we found. Mm-hmm. But the prosecuting authority didn't know where they were. The family didn't know where they were. Just disappeared out of prison. Not gone through, it seems, the parole system. So, you know, maybe a little bit of either bad paperwork or corruption or something along those lines. But these seem to be the kinds of things that are, again, not a vastly distant reality for us. And it might be actually interesting to hear and invite some of the listeners to share with us kind of stories around their experiences with the parole system. Going back to Oscar, what kind of... so please do send us your story. If you've got any interesting tales of woe or success stories with the parole system, please do share them with us. Going back to Oscar, what kind of guy was he in prison? Because there's the in-prison behavior component which plays a factor. Now, as you've always said, a psychopath in prison is typically a model prisoner. So if I'm a serial killer going into prison without any real kind of my docket going into the prison to inform everyone of why I'm there, and then after 25 years, all the lawyers and the policemen and everyone that was involved in my case has now disappeared into the ether and emigrated to New Zealand, or working security for mines around the continent. You know, that person then starts a new life in a system and in a place that is suitable to their mental condition, you know, that helps to manage their mental condition, however you want to put it. And so they begin their 25 years of a wonderful prison record. This also leads me then into the station strangler discussion, because I mean, clearly there are people that will display good behavior and seemingly are ready to go back into society, but who, when assessed by the likes of yourself, may be totally kind of inappropriate to put them back into that kind of environment.
I always feel that you don't need to be a psychopath, but if you are good at manipulating people, a good con man, and you either A, have money, doesn't have to be lots of money, you have money, or a skill, like you're good at computers or something that you can leverage off to get some good favor in correctional services, you can do very well. And you won't be necessarily in trouble for anything, because you can, again, either get your way out of it, or you're just able to survive because of your money or skills and your con man abilities in the prison setting. So does that mean you've been rehabilitated? Absolutely not. So it shouldn't just be, and I think my experience is correctional services plays a lot of emphasis on two things when you come up with that parole hearing. Do you show remorse? Meaning, I feel so bad about what I've done. Now, how do you judge that? That's a difficult thing to judge. But at first step is, yes, it was me, I acknowledge it, I did it, and I feel very bad, shame, poor family. That's kind of how they kind of going to judge your remorse aspect. And B, have you been well behaved? You know, did you get into lots of fights? Did you have infringements, you know, being found with contraband? Did you at least tick the boxes for whatever minimum little courses? Now, when I'm talking about a lot of these correctional services courses.
What about proactivity and taking part in actual rehabilitation programs?
So when you arrive, they're supposed to assess and say, right, you need to do the following in the next, you know, whatever many years. Some prisoners, you know, think, screw that, I'm not going to, until they suddenly come up for parole and they suddenly tick all those boxes. Now, a lot of these boxes are like a one-day course. Some of them run by other offenders, some of them run by social workers, maybe some of them run by psychologists, and you literally just have to not fall asleep and show a basic level of participation, and you'll get that little certificate. So do they really change you? I don't necessarily think they do. Okay. And then if you've done that, you're probably, because they seem to think that you should be released when you get to the minimum detention period if you've done the basics. Forgetting that your sentence, when the court gives you a sentence, it's about numerous things. It's about punishment for what you've done. Retribution, society getting its retribution against you. It's about deterring you from doing that crime again, but also deterring me who saw you get punished, thinking, wow, that's not a good idea. I don't want to end up happening to me what happened to that guy. So I'm not going to do what he did. You know, rehabilitation, etc. So there's a whole bunch of factors that the court takes into account when they give that sentence. Correctional services doesn't seem to take those into account. They just seem to think you should probably be released unless it's something really bad. And if you've done the bare minimum and kept your nose clean, you should be released. And I don't think that's, for me, that's undermining the court and what the court gave when they gave that sentence. So basically, that's how you can manipulate yourself through the system, and it doesn't mean you're achieved. I know people who, I think in prison, if you are determined to change, you'll change whether or not you have any courses. Because you can get through these courses as a matter of just ticking the tick box exercise. And we saw that with a guy like Stefan Skotsia, who was one of the bombers in the mid-90s, you know, in the times when the country was changing, who planted a bomb in Worcester along with, I think, four other people, and some people died. There was no de-radicalization programs. There was no... It was really his determination to eventually accept what he did and to realize that he was wrong and to want to change.
Yeah.
That caused him to actually get on a path of change and reconciling with all his victims and their families, etc. And he really is literally the poster boy. If you go for restorative justice, Stefan Skotsia is literally the poster boy for restorative justice. Mm. But it was his own. He's written a couple of books. It was his own motivation to want to be different.
Yeah.
And there that's the key element.
There was no program that was going to work unless he had the will to do it.
Exactly. So going through programs doesn't mean you've changed. So unfortunately, I think correctional services is looking at one part of the bigger picture of why you've been sentenced in the first place by a court. And that's a big issue I have. And I do think the whole system should be revamped from the moment you get into that prison, what information is available about you, to a scientific analysis of what your needs are, to scientific programs that have been proven to actually work, because I don't think there's any outcome studies on these programs that they're implementing, to show, are you better off for having undergone this program or not? And, you know, even in the UK, there was this one sexual offender program that was used across the UK in their prisons. Later studies actually showed that you were worse off having done that program.
Okay.
Than even if you
shouldn't
didn't
you be
do
getting psychology students at WITS to do these things?
No, I think we should you know go beyond that and the best minds in terms of sex. Look at research what has been shown to work out there,
yeah.
Adapt it for South Africa, and then do a study to see whether those people who've done that program are less likely. So we're talking long term stuff, you know, less likely after release to have been offending within a 5-year period. So we are talking long term, but you know the prisons aren't going anywhere, and offenders aren't. You're always going to have new offenders. So to say, well, that'll take 5 years. Who cares?
Yeah, where we go, yeah.
You know, to say, let's not do it, are we better off? No, then we're just looking at what looks nice and implementing it and hoping for the best.
Do you think Oscar should have been eligible for parole and should have been released? Your personal opinion.
Yeah, you asked us now Oscar's behavior in prison. I don't know what Oscar's behavior has been.
Do you
like
not have any insights
I don't have any insights into that. I would assume that considering they gave him parole that he'd been relatively well behaved.
Yeah.
So I think what's also important with parole, and this also touches on Oscar, is that we should have some kind of a scientific assessment, firstly, to determine whether a person is safe to be released. But I would like to say that if another person who, let's say, spontaneously shot his girlfriend and who went to prison and went through the same programs that Oscar went through and behaved the same way Oscar behaved, behaved during his time in prison, if that person would be eligible for parole, then Oscar should also be.
Okay.
The minute we decide, well, Oscar's a high-profile guy, or we don't like Oscar, you know, we don't like Yannis Wallace, so we're going to treat him differently. But everybody else who did the same kinds of things as that, as a similar kind of offenses as this particular offender, then Oscar should be released. Otherwise, we're playing favoritism, and where does that stop? That's a slippery slope, because tomorrow this group of people are favorable, and when the change of politics, that person's favorable. Mm. That we can't have that, because then we're not applying some kind of basic fairness and equality in terms of how we assess someone's ability to be paroled. And that is a dangerous, very slippery slope, because tomorrow it's you or me who are in trouble.
Yeah.
And we're getting judged, well, Paul's from this group, or Paul's that person, or Jero's like this, and he's part of that faction, so we're not going to give him where anybody else would have. Then where are we? So I don't per se, I mean, look, from what I know of Oscar and his background, from my insights in the investigation and the trial, I don't think Oscar's a very high risk for reoffending, to be honest with you. I think probably a lot of what was his risk factors, his perhaps you can say his arrogance, if you want to put it that way, his recklessness, his access to firearms. I'd like to think that after 13 or more years in prison, he's thought twice about his behavior. He's grown up in prison. Hopefully some of the courses he went on helped, yes. You know, he's not going to be legally able to access a firearm. I don't think Oscar's a really a huge risk, to be honest with you, for killing a future girlfriend.
Yeah.
He didn't have a history of domestic violence. He might not have been the nicest person all the time in his relationships. Yeah. So I don't think Oscar really is a big risk. So I don't really have a big issue with Oscar being released. And like I said, if anybody else who'd done the same thing and gone through the same pathway in correctional services has been released, then Oscar should also be released.
Yeah. I often wonder these days if South Africans read the manual for a democracy before they bought one. Because it's like, you know, these are exactly the kinds of things we need to always be in consideration of, is the fact that if we're going to kind of continue to be citizens who support the idea of a democracy, we have to support the idea that these types of equalities are readily available to all of us. Like, you know, like everyone's opinion is valid and allowed, whether it offends you or upsets you or not. You know, with regards to the Oscar case, it seems to me that the parole part of it is not the issue. The issue was really with the investigation and the case itself, and the fact that maybe had it been handled differently, it could have been a bit more clear cut that Oscar acted in a certain way. Maybe was a bit more of a... But, you know, there were a lot of gray areas, a lot of issues, it seems, with the manner in which the scene was investigated from day one. And then, obviously, some very high-powered, wily lawyers involved from there
who thrive on
that kind of... on a little bit of chaos that the case started
with. I think that one of the biggest issues is that the judge never said whether this was a careless, reckless shooting or it was an intimate partner murder.
Yeah, there's no definitive sense.
Now, was it a job to necessarily comment on that? I don't know, but we don't have those answers, and only Oscar would know. So,
and a judge would typically do something like that, wouldn't they?
Usually, you know. So ultimately what we have, and this is what after the appeal processes went through, is that the court said in Oscar's case, you didn't have the right to shoot anybody at that point in time, no matter who it was. Guy with a gun behind that door or your girlfriend, you had no legal grounds to be shooting someone. And you firing four bullets into a door that you think someone is busy opening, and you don't think that that would necessarily lead to someone's injury, possible death. That's why he was found guilty of murder, dolus eventualis. So the court, in that sense, didn't need to comment on whether he knew he was shooting Reva or he generally thought it was, because they said it actually, in a way, doesn't matter. You didn't have grounds. That wasn't your only option left, was to fire four bullets through that door. You could have backed down the passage, pressed the alarm, gotten out the house. You weren't trapped. You had a gun, which is a great equalizer in the world of, you know, I don't care whether you're in a wheelchair. If you've got a gun, you're just as dangerous as me with a gun at that point in time. So that's kind of what the appeal court ultimately said, the SCA down in Bloemfontein. So we have a lot of questions which maybe just out of curiosity people would like to know, but did he know he was shooting her? Or did he really think it was? Because that's where people polarize towards.
Yeah.
I think he knew and he was angry with her versus poor guy. Maybe it was understandable that he thought. But either of those options, the court said, but you didn't have the right to kill someone at that point in time.
Absolutely. So another case that is, you know, kind of helps us to illuminate some of the realities of the parole system here in South Africa would be the story of Norman Simons. Now, he was prosecuted and convicted of the murder of 10-year-old Elroy Van Rooyen in 1995. But this was on the tail end of a string of 22 young boys who'd been found dead, sodomized, strangled, in the Cape Flats area in the Western Cape.
From the 80s already.
Going back to 1986, I think. Now, he was never charged or prosecuted for any of those cases. It was just the... So there is a big question mark around whether or not Norman Simons was the station strangler, and whether or not that guy actually... whether or not somebody got away with it.
Yeah.
That said, the popular narrative has been that Norman Simons was the station strangler. Let's start there.
So a lot of people, like you say, don't know that he wasn't convicted of others or even charged with the others. A lot of people think he was convicted of murdering a bunch of kids. So that's the important starting point, is that the prosecutors never felt there was enough evidence to charge him with any of the others, despite him having done pointing outs, et cetera, et cetera. and he was just charged with Elroy von Royen's murder. And even the prosecutor in that case said, all we actually had was an ID parade where the lady said, you know, I think it looks like that one, which normally that wouldn't be a very convincing piece of evidence. So even the prosecutor, it was a TV interview with him, Mike Stowe, I think his name was, said, I was very surprised, you know, that we got a conviction.
Okay.
So you can't separate from the politics of the time. This is 1994, 95, change in South African government. The police want to make it look like they're definitely putting their efforts into, you know, the murders of people from the non-white community, if you want to use the terminology. A lot of pressure. The community literally was rioting. I mean, when Simons was eventually arrested and put into the cells, the community literally rioted outside that police station. So you can't separate it from the pressure of, geez, we have to prosecute somebody. And we can't have an... Imagine if you had a not guilty conviction just on even on Elroy's case. So I'm not saying the judge intentionally might have, but you can't say that that wasn't weighing in the back of the mind subconsciously, if you wanted to use that terminology. So we have him convicted. It went to the appeal court. His legal representative, Koos Lowe, I think it was, advocate Koos Lowe, went on to the appeal court and thought, well, we've got a good, you know, we're going to get this overturned. The appeal court upheld it and I think actually extended his sentence to make it longer. So that's how we end up with him. Now, what evidence was there? I mean, just quickly to touch on this because it's important. A lot of people don't realize this. There was DNA evidence from some of the other cases. So two of the cases of the young boys, they found, remember, 1994, 95, DNA was in its infancy in South Africa. SAPS wasn't even doing it. UCT, the university, was doing it. They'd found two DNA samples from different cases that didn't match Norman Simon's DNA.
Yeah.
One of those was later reprocessed using the modern DNA technology.
In 2010.
Still didn't match Norman Simons. When I went with my team of people back, was it 2010 or more, we went back to relook at some of these cases. We had a second look at these cases and other cases. We tracked down the second old-fashioned DNA sample, brought it up to Pretoria, had it reanalyzed using modern technology. The two modern technology samples matched each other and still didn't match Norman Simons. So now we have definitely two different semen samples from two separate cases back from then, from the 90s, that weren't matching Norman Simons.
And these are this is semen taken from the body crime of scenes, the victim. Yeah. So this is odds on that this is
and
DNA.
Two
from
separate cases matching each other. So even if it was some random person who walked by and coughed and some DNA, you know, DNA landed, but now you have two separate crime scenes, the same DNA appearing. That is not statistically possible unless you, and it's from semen. So, you know, that you were involved.
Yeah.
Of course, now people say, well, then Simons must have had a co-accused. So now all of a sudden you hear for the first time people bringing in a co-accused, which, I mean, you didn't say that until we suddenly have two samples of DNA that don't match your guy.
Yeah.
So some people are hell-bent on still keeping him in their minds as the station strangler, as Norman Simons referring to. And when we went to look down at these cases in 2010, my team of people that went down, we were finding other cases that occurred after Simons' arrest that had a very similar, eerily similar crime scene and victimology. So anyway, I can confirm.
We need to come back to this.
Yeah, I can confirm.
We're
going to
come back to this with a whole series of solving cold cases. And
I can confirm that towards the end of last year, I met with the cold case team from the Western Cape who are relooking at these, along with the investigative psychology section. They have all the stuff that we looked at in 2010, and I had a consultation. So that is being re-looked at. I have my thoughts on a very likely suspect, which I'd even had back in 2010, but if I recall correctly, he had passed away, and it probably wouldn't have been enough to exhume his body at that point, which I've conveyed to the new team that I think person X was a very good candidate for a suspect to be looked into. So essentially now we fast forward, and I think even correctional services people were thinking station strangler, station strangler. So is it fair to judge Norman Simons when he comes up for parole as the station strangler?
That's a big question.
Whether overtly or in the back of your mind. I mean, he was in prison for 23 years. Was it 23 or 28 years? Let me just check my... 28 years.
I guess the reality here is that if you are of the belief that Norman Simons is the station strangler, then his being let out on parole would seem to be really crazy. Because if you've killed and buried 22 kids that the police are aware of in shallow graves in your murder area, you are definitely not the... I mean, I can leap into your body and assume that you will tell me that that guy should never be let out of prison.
I don't think any
regardless of how well behaved he is.
I don't think any convicted serial murderer, in other words, you're convicted of murdering two or more victims in separate cases, I don't think any of them should be released back into society because the risk is too great. We don't know what makes you a serial murderer. We don't know how to fix you. Therefore, saying, let's just take a chance and see what happens and how it goes, I think that's absolutely irresponsible. So I don't think any convicted serial murderer should be let out. So if Simons had been convicted on the second one, or if I in my heart of hearts knew he was, I would be championing to say, no, and thinking of ways we can try and keep him in. The reality is the evidence was dodgy that got him convicted on that one. I don't think in modern courts nowadays he would have been convicted, to be very honest with you, in my opinion.
Okay. So it seems like the fact that he was kind of let out and there seemed to be quite a good effort to kind of conceal some of the important details around that, exactly where he'd be, when he'd be. And I think that seems fair enough, considering the amount of gray area that exists with regards to this case. This is certainly a case which is very interesting to re-explore, though, isn't it? It's interesting to consider what his life must be like now, you know, until there's, you know, because and essentially, for all intents and purposes, the world thinks he's the station strangler.
You know what's interesting? I think it was it the later version, Checkpoint on ENCA, I think, did a story about this during last year, 2023, and I think another TV documentary or news people did another story. And when they spoke to some of the family members of the victims, they weren't aware that there was actually DNA and that it didn't match Simons. So, again, the families, you know, who's at fault for that? I don't know how to explain it. You know, some of the families also don't have the full picture. And of course, you can understand the families would be championing to say he must never come out because they see him as the person responsible for the killing of their own children. I absolutely understand that. I would be championing that he mustn't come out. So I think, you know, the full picture is now really perhaps coming out. I think there's also been enough years that there's a bit more objectivity. You know, the younger generation hasn't even heard of him necessarily or the details. I mean, when you and I were doing that documentary on Stuart Wilk and Wootie Boot, when we for another TV show many years ago, and you would say to the waitress, do you know who Stuart Wilk and Wootie Boot is? And they would go like, who are you talking about?
So
people forget.
And that's
emotions.
In Port Elizabeth. Yeah, that's Elizabeth. In the local area.
You know, not much else happens there. So people's move on emotionally, etc. So I think it's perhaps ripe for it to be re-looked at, in fairness to trying to catch the real killer, or if there was a co-accused, who that co-accused is. You know, we've got DNA to bring some closure for some of the family members and unanswered questions, and perhaps, you know, shift it away from saying Norman, because there actually is no evidence that it's Norman.
Yeah. So maybe we need to take a look. I think definitely we need to address this case and maybe see if we can speak to some people who are, you know, really up to speed with the current status and see where that's at. But wow, what a great opportunity to go and what an amazing cold case that must be to reinvestigate, because those are some heinous crimes, and I'm sure that there are a lot of family members who may now be aware of the fact that there was DNA evidence, etc., that would like to have some more clarity and resolution and maybe a bit more peace of mind as to, you know, whether or not the person that committed all those crimes actually was convicted. So we got Oscar, who we consider to be, you know, if the parole system's going to be fair, you know, whether we like Oscar or not, it's not unreasonable that he's out.
I don't think
parole.
There's controversy, to be honest with you, about Oscar being released. I think it's just a high-profile figure, so it creates interest.
There's
but I don't think it's controversy.
Gray area with regard to the Norman Simons case. That folks, you know, let him be, and let's rather focus on figuring out whether the case is, whether it was him or not. And then thirdly, the third case we wanted to touch on, and we've spoken a lot already, but is the Donovan Mudley case. Now, this is somebody who is not currently out on parole, but is very much in the process of eligible, is very much eligible and has been through a number of parole hearings already. Just give us a quick lowdown.
So again, I just want to disclaim, I am involved. The Matthews family had asked me to be an advisor or an expert contributing towards the documentation they wanted to submit and to be present at the parole hearing. So I just want to put that on the table. So I'm only going to comment on the publicly available information that anybody can go and find. So yes, as I said earlier in this podcast, Donovan Mudley should only have had a parole hearing in 2029 due to some constitutional court decisions. A whole bunch of offenders in a certain category had their parole dates brought forward. Now all of a sudden, 2019. So let's jump back, though. What did he plead guilty to? In essence, for those of you who don't recall, he kidnapped Lee Matthews from Bond University in Sandton, demanded a certain amount of money from the Matthews family. Later on that night, Rob Matthews, her father, dropped off, say, 50,000 Rand, I think it was, negotiated down to, on the side of a highway, with the expectation that Lee would be released. Lee wasn't. And about, I think it was, 9th of July 2004, Lee was kidnapped. 21st of July, her body is found in Walkerville, naked, about 4 gunshot wounds to the head. And the body didn't look like it had been out at that point in time for 3 weeks. I actually coincidentally was present. I want to just say that on that day the body was coincidentally found, a team from head office where I was based, head office of serious and violent crime, was called in for a briefing to find out what's going on with the investigating officer at that time, which was warrant officer or inspector Gabriel Hall, was in the investigating officer before Police Bedefeld. So a whole bunch of us from SVC head office went out there with General Skutter to hear what's going on, to get a briefing, to see if SVC head office could assist in any way, etc., and just to make sure the investigation was going as we would hope. And while we were there, literally there was a phone call saying, hey, a body's been found. So I went out to the crime scene. If I hadn't been there that day, I wouldn't have been called out to the crime scene. It was just coincidence. Mm-hmm. Went out to the crime scene, saw the body, and I think then I was present at the autopsy along with a bunch of other people, pretty much that same team. And that's the only involvement I had. I don't even think there's a statement from me in the docket and I didn't testify, etc. It was by chance and coincidence that those two things happened. So I also just want to point out, because I see someone on Twitter posted on, you know, some quite criticism that I'm a racist. I don't know where that came from. And that controversial news, I found out that you were there. You shouldn't be involved in the Matthews parole process, which I don't think that's actually necessarily true. So just to state all of that for the record. So essentially, suddenly his parole date's brought forward by a number of years. But in between that, so like I said, what did he plead guilty to? So he pled guilty to the kidnapping. Guilty plea means, in his own words, he's admitting what he's done. He prepares a guilty plea with his lawyer, and that's presented in court. And based on that, you will then be found guilty. So in other words, there's no trial where evidence is presented. And he essentially pled guilty to, look, in his own words, I knew I couldn't release Lee, that she would be able to identify me. Therefore, I decided I'm going to have to basically kill her. I took her out to this field, told her to get undressed so I could basically keep the clothes for forensic purposes. I gave her a blanket to put over her, and as she turned her back to me, in other words, turned away from me, I shot her in the back of the head. I think we'll all agree that's an execution killing.
I mean, it sounds pretty convincing.
I knew she couldn't
convincing.
Go, yeah. And as she turned her, I shot her and basically shot her 4 times.
Yeah.
So what's he fast forward telling the parole board now that we suddenly have these hearings?
I'm excited to hear.
I was going to let, I decided to let her go. So I went out to the field of Walkerville, deserted area. I was going to give her a cell phone so she could call someone or go to a farmhouse. I can't recall one of the two. That's not particularly important. But I did want to take the clothes for forensic purposes and was giving her a blanket, and she must have thought I was going to rape her. So she panicked and I panicked and the gun went off. And then I fired 3 more shots to put her out of her misery.
Oh, what
that
a terrible
version
accident.
Is more of like, oh dear, I wasn't going to kill her. Oopsie, we both panicked and the gun went off. And oh dear, she's dead.
Yeah.
Now, if a correctional services, going back to what we sent, if you're the psychologist who doesn't actually have the guilty plea in front of him or her, you're not going to be, hang on, Donovan, that's a bit of a different version that you're describing.
Exactly.
One is literally an execution. The other one is, oh, damn it.
Yeah, I mean, he's even suggesting that she played a role in the terrible accident.
No, she hadn't panicked, she would have been free.
Yeah.
So, and again, this is public information, so I'm not revealing secrets.
Sure.
Now we look at what happened in between his pleading guilty all those years ago in, was it 2005, to now, what he's saying at the parole board hearings. And we have him, and he actually says in his own court documents, I studied an LLB so I could deal with my own legal applications. That's actually in one of his... He had numerous attempts to get a retrial, to have his case, you know, overturned. And he said things from anything from it wasn't me that did it at all to I was coerced with a bunch of other people to do it to X, Y. I mean, I think there's like, last I counted, 4, 5, 6, 7 different versions of events in between the guilty plea and what he was telling the parole board. But again, like, for example, the psychologist who doing the assessment didn't know any of that. So he's chopped and changed. And I do think that if you still think, my gosh, my goodness, I've got 10 more years to parole hearing, it's kind of worth trying to get your case overturned, isn't it?
Mm.
But now all of a sudden, boom, constitutional court cases, not from him, but from other prisoners, bring your parole date forward by 10 years. You can't go to the parole board saying, I didn't do it. Because they'll say, sorry, if you're not accepting responsibility, you're not going to get parole.
Yeah.
So now you have to go back to, it was me, but maybe you want to soften it a little bit by saying, I was going to let her go. So we have this, and these are all court documents that people
and
go
like
and
we've
read.
Discussed, there's not the historical, institutional
knowledge
continuity of knowledge as to what happened, despite the bold efforts of the Matthews family even to stay
to
involved and retain some of that knowledge in the whole case.
So I wasn't allowed. We did ask if I could assess Murray. That was turned down. So I was basically working on court documents to say what I could based just on the court documents. And the key issue that I kind of presented in my report is that how much remorse do you actually have if you've chopped and changed your version so many times quite differently? And that was one of my key concerns that should be considered by the parole board. The parole hearing itself, 2019, was a bit of a shambles. I mean, I sat there thinking, my goodness, this is a circus. So I 100% agree with Donovan Moodley when he goes to court saying this process is not fair and it's a circus. Donovan Moodley, I state on record, I agree with you. What I saw in those two parole hearings, because then that court said, well, I can't review what happened because there's like one page of minutes from this 4 or 5 hour long parole hearing. So I therefore, the court, Rick say that he must have a new hearing, and that's what happened last year. A new hearing before the same parole board, but that hearing was also an absolute circus. We had definitely the policeman who fell asleep, because we suddenly hear a phone vibrating, and you know, normally when you realize your phone's vibrating, you'll quickly turn it off, and we kind of look around and we see, my goodness, the policeman's napping. And I think one of the other parole board members also kind of had a bit of a nodding off in the process. And, you know, Moodley brought two lawyers, which the chairperson of the parole board said, you can't say anything, Mr. Lawyers, and you can't contribute, you can't interview, you can just sit there and listen. You can't even sit next to your client. So when Moodley was unhappy with that way that parole process went on, which I, again, on for the record, Moodley, I agree with you, it was a circus. The courts kind of said, but, you know, this is unfairly done, because what's the point of being saying you can have a legal advisor if they're not allowed to legal advise you?
Yeah.
And this and that and the other irregularities. So the courts are going to instruct again that a different parole board this time. Because the first two ones, it was the same group of, and I have to be very tactful, people.
Yes.
And it now has to be before a different parole board completely, as I understand it. So subsequent to that, and I think quite frankly, if this one doesn't go fairly and justly, I think quite frankly, if Donovan Moodley goes back to the court again, the court might just actually decide, parole boards, you've had three chances, you've bugged them all up, we are going to then instruct that you be granted parole.
Yeah.
Will the parole board give him parole at the third hearing? I think there's a very good chance they might, to be honest with you, just because they're trying to cut their losses and say, let's just give it to him, because they'd maybe rather have the unhappiness of the family than being taken into court again.
Yes.
You know, now coming to the one that, as I said, the two that had happened previously, where I was present throughout those hearings that took place. You know, the psychologist didn't have a lot of the information that I mentioned now about the different versions of events. The psychologist, I think she did have the actual guilty plea because she, no, the judgment by the judge, because she hauled out one section where she says the offender shows remorse. But if you read the whole judgment by the judge very clearly states that he's not telling the truth and he's not remorseful. So I don't know why she was selective in what she pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
She also didn't have all the other changing versions for some reason. She said he has no internal infringements when, quite frankly, correctional service presented, he has three internal infringements. I think two for being in possession of money, which you're not allowed to have in prison, and one being in possession of a cell phone.
Okay. So
she said he had no internal. So that, unfortunately, led to the Matthews family laying a complaint at the Health Professions Council at the end of last year, saying this person did not meet professional standards, which I unfortunately have to agree.
Okay.
And I was supportive of that complaint. And she was found guilty at the Health Professions Council in, I think, December, and fined 10,000 rands for unprofessional behavior. So those types of things don't help. Because I can guarantee you now, no correctional service psychologist wants to be the one to now have to assess this.
But what are the chances that these kinds of issues are only cropping up with the Donovan Moodley case?
This is just a case that's under the spotlight because you have a family. I mean, the Matthews family, you know, they're not a wealthy family. People make the mistake and think they're some, you know, millions and millionaires and billionaires. They're not. They're quite, you know, they're an average middle class, maybe even upper middle class family. Yeah. You know, just had people who'd hard worked and studied and worked for a company, you know, Rob Matthews. So, you know, but there are people that have access to, are willing to spend and access and money to approach lawyers to get involved and assist and advise, who have, you know, could approach me and had the perhaps the social standing to know where to look for help. Whereas, you know, again, a poor family who's living in formal settlement, not going to have access to those resources. So this is just where cases come under the spotlight.
So if it's bad with a case that's under the spotlight, imagine what it's like for cases that
absolutely
aren't.
And again, I'll even say again, if Donovan Woodley meets the same expectations or behaviors that any other person who's killed someone has been given parole, then I don't object to Donovan Woodley parole because that's kind of the benchmark. I don't think we have that. I think we have a lot of unanswered questions. We have a lot of bad assessment. We have a lot of chopping and changing of, did I do it? No, I didn't. I did it. I did it under duress. I did it with other people. And also never ever telling us who those other people were.
Yeah.
You know, there's still big questions about whether he acted alone and where was the body for so many days. And he changes his version of events about where the body was and the conditions. And we've had forensic pathologists look at this and go, but it's not medically possible that a body could be in such a pristine condition at the crime scene based on what you are saying.
Yeah.
And he doesn't obviously understand forensic pathology and decomposition because he seems to think, well, she was near water. It was the coldest winter and she was wrapped in a blanket. And again, forensic pathologists have looked at this and say, but no, you would still have a higher rate of
decomposition.
They've
been through that. They know all the different kind of, all the different versions of a body after 4 weeks of being dead.
And I think all the Matthews family wants, I guess I'd like to think like any family, is that it's a proper, transparent, properly conducted method of assessment to determine whether or not should be given parole. And like I always say, if it meets the current benchmarks of everybody else, parole should be granted. If it doesn't, I do think we need to revamp the process.
Yeah.
But, you know, that process isn't here now, so we can't wish.
Do you think what there should be such a thing as a sentence of life without parole?
You know, there is already something of that called, I think it's a dangerous criminal classification or indeterminate sentence, where if someone is deemed to be a psychopath, we can take the parole out of the hands of correctional services. We are a judge, and we did this with the Velcom case. Remember, we talked about the Velcom case, Shanae Fonyera and Martin Svanemare, who killed Michael Fonek and chopped up his body.
Of course.
So Shanae was given the indeterminate sentence where the court said, right, in 20 years, you won't have a parole hearing. You'll come back before ideally the same judge, but if not another judge. And you have to argue in court why and prove that you've been rehabilitated, which means, of course, the prosecution will be able to counteract that argument. And if the court feels you haven't been rehabilitated, I think they can then give another 10 years and you have to come back in 10 years' time to the court, the high court, and again argue that you've been released. And then at that point, the court can say, I think you can give another 10 years maybe, or say, yes, I think you've been rehabilitated. You ought to be released.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it seems like a lot of prosecutors don't want to do that because I think at the end of the trial, they're just so tired of it. They just, let's go through it. You know, unless he's going to get life or he's going to get 25 years or 10 years or 15 years. Let's just leave it at that, which is sad because that's one mechanism where you can have, A, the control isn't in the hands of correctional services. You can have a fairly lengthy sentence. That's why it's called indeterminate sentence, where a person under the eyes of a judge will determine whether or not to be released. Should we just generally have a life without parole? I think we should have life where your parole is dealt with by the court. So at 25 years, you'll have a little mini case about whether, so it's kind of like the indeterminate sentence, except at least this does have some, you know, endpoint, I guess. I think that will be a good in-between. I think the Constitutional Court has already decided that life without parole is unconstitutional. It constitutes what was the term? Like a horrific, no, it's not the word, but an exceptional punishment. Horrific is not the right word. It's going to come to me after we finish the podcast. So that's already been determined as not a possibility. So we can kind of put that one aside as much as we put aside death penalty. Because our government's never going to change that and we'll take a constitutional decision to change it. So that is what we have right now, this indeterminate sentence option. I think we can maybe change that, you know, like I said, it used to be 20 years on a life sentence. It was up to 25, so that's already a positive step in the right direction, I guess you could say. But we maybe argue that there should be further requirements. The problem is there's so many people with a life sentence, and even the current ones, because once the parole board makes a decision on a life sentenced person, it goes to the minister.
Yeah.
The minister then has a little team of people that decides. And that committee doesn't sit very often. So already there's a massive backlog on the lifers who've been recommended for parole that's gone to the minister.
None of these things are easy to consider in lieu of a really, really appropriately sized and managed and put together correctional services system.
No.
So until the actual, you know, the sex system has to be fixed first, doesn't it? The actual, how it's put together.
Absolutely, because it's unfair.
Before you can get into the reeds with this kind of stuff.
So let's say there are life sentence people who the parole board feels is justified to be granted parole, and let's take just for granted they did a good job in that assessment. It's then unfair that those guys, and maybe women, who have been recommended on a life sentence for parole, and now that committee of the minister doesn't sit very often, because you can imagine the minister's a busy person. But not just the minister, the committee of people to sit and go through, there must be probably hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of applications. How long does it take to go through one? It's unfair for those people who maybe do actually deserve being given parole, but the minister's team isn't getting together to sit and look at them and say, yes, I agree, off you go, there's your parole. That's also unfair. So the system is unfair on both sides, to the offenders, and also, of course, to the families. It's not a good system for anybody. And I'm not just arguing for reformation so that we can keep prisoners and longer for jail. I'm arguing for a fair system that's transparent, that is effective, that is scientifically based or evidence-based, that's beneficial for everybody. Offenders, their victims, their families, the families of the offenders, and everybody and society. That's really what should be.
So let's stop privatizing correctional services. Let's stop privatizing the entire law enforcement infrastructure of the country, folks. I have a few questions just to wrap up. First of all, I'm just curious what your opinion is on capital punishment. That's my first question. And then I'm going to ask you pros and cons of the current system, which we've, I think, covered a bit of, but just to really kind of summate. And then, you know, what we as listeners should take away from this conversation. If, you know, if we ever found ourselves, for example, if we found ourselves ever in a situation where we have to engage the parole system.
So firstly, the capital punishment argument. Well, firstly, it's been proven that it doesn't matter what punishment you have. If people don't think they're going to get caught and convicted, it doesn't matter. If I think the chances of me getting the death penalty for killing my girlfriend, if the chances of me getting caught are slim, and the chances are even slimmer of me getting convicted, then I don't care what the punishment is, because I don't think I'll ever face it. So that's the first thing. So you have to have a functioning investigation and prosecution system for any minimum sentence to be really a deterrent. Secondly, I don't think having a death sentence will determine some kind of murders and not other ones. Will it determine intimate partner murders and domestic violence situations? No, because most of those guys know they're going to get caught because they do it in a way they're going to get caught. And I think in the heightened emotions of that moment, you're not thinking about the consequences, right? So I don't think it's going to do much to determine intimate partner murders. Might it determine the housebreaker who breaks in if he's pretty much sure he's going to die if he gets caught and convicted? It might determine that guy, or the hijacker. Maybe it might make him think twice about pulling that trigger for willingly reasons.
Are you saying capital, Jared, you're not supporting capital punishment for house break-ins, are you?
Well, that's a separate argument. Who should be worthy of it? I do think, quite frankly, I think child molesters and child rapists should probably get that.
Look, capital punishment is certainly on brand for the species, but, you know, we're quite a violent bunch.
Yeah.
But might it be if certain people are executed, it solves the whole problem of ever having to consider parole for them anyway down the line.
I think if
you don't have to worry about putting them back into society, because you can't.
I think it depends why you want it. If you want it just because you feel that if you kill someone, eye for an eye, end of your story. Or if you rape a child or rape a woman or a serial rapist, sorry, sunshine, you've proven you don't belong to society. That's okay. Well, I'm saying that's then fine.
Whether that's what you require to have your sense of justice satisfied. Yeah.
But if you're thinking, well, this will overall stop all murders because people don't, well, no, it might stop some, but it won't stop all. So it's, what is your reason for it? And again, if we don't have a good functioning, effective justice system, it means nothing. We can have beheading, we can have death by drawn and quartered by a horse, by four horses. If you don't think any court, doesn't matter. If we don't have a good justice system to get people investigated, arrested, produce a case in court that's beyond a reasonable doubt and convicted, it means absolutely nothing.
You know what? We don't have enough data from you know, being people being drawn and quartered in the square with, you know, with, we'll with families having picnics watching. Yeah. And pros and cons then. Let's wrap up our parole discussion. Pros and cons of the parole system, things we can be positive about, things we need to be concerned about, and advice for anyone who has to deal with them.
I have difficulty seeing any pros in a system that I just know is not based on any kind of science or evidence and has not been implemented. Yes, hopefully the good guys who have done well, who've behaved in prison, who are generally changed inside, they'll hopefully be getting it through this current ineffective system, because they'll sail through on, I guess, what currently the parole boards are looking for, which is you've kept your nose clean, done some courses, improved yourself, feel bad, off you go. The cons are that's not too difficult to fake. And I don't think there's science behind it. Even correctional services psychologists in 2020, I actually trained every single correctional services psychologist at the time, I think except one or two who couldn't make the training, on risk assessment tools for violence, domestic violence, sexual violence, stalking. But there's no policy by correctional services that that's the way we're going to do it now. So every psychologist is kind of left to their own devices. And even the one in the Donovan Woodley case I mentioned now, she attended my training, didn't apply any of the principles because I've reviewed a report. None of the principles I applied were actually done. So you
because
kind of,
there's no watchdog monitoring
people,
her.
Yeah, people can do whatever they want. There's no correctional services policy. This is how it will be done because we've researched it, and this is the best methods for a psychologist to assess risk.
Yeah.
Not there. So that's the problem. It's like,
these don't sound like difficult things to do.
No.
It requires the will, it requires the investment, and it requires a bit of good management.
Policy decision is this is the best way we're going to do it.
Yeah.
So quite frankly, the bad is it's a shit show right now. How these things, and even the, and as I said, I know quite a few psychologists and social workers and correctional services, and they're pulling their hair out saying, but our recommendations are ignored, you know, and the people we definitely say shouldn't be getting released are released. And when we ask, they say, well, your report's just one of the bunch of things we consider. Well, you know, I think a psychologist's report should be given not just the same weight as the guy who looks after the offender in that section.
Totally. Yeah, exactly.
So I don't,
who a highly manipulative criminal person who's a highly manipulative criminal has had years and years to
and with
to,
the,
to bring into their cult essentially.
And there's rampant corruption. Yeah. I mean, in the correctional service amongst the warders, helping smuggle and stuff in. So again, there are some good ones and honest ones and loyal ones. I'm not disregarding them, but we have to unfortunately work on the fact that there are a lot of them that aren't.
Yeah.
So. I can't say much beyond that. Quite frankly, it's a shit show and absolutely needs to be reformed start to finish. To people out there, well, God forbid you're ever involved in the process as an offender, but I would definitely, if you're the victims, start asking questions at the prison where the person who could offended against your family is. Make contact and have record that you wanted to be involved, that you do it all on email. Because that is some kind of proof that you can present. A phone call, unless you recorded the phone call, which you're entitled to do legally in South Africa.
Keep a paper
without,
trail.
And I want to make this clear. In South Africa, you are allowed to record a phone call if you are a participant of that phone call, and you don't have to tell the other person. You have to be a participant of that phone call.
Okay.
So as long as you're talking in that phone call, you don't have to tell the other person.
Okay.
But emails are a good record trail. Recorded conversations are a good record trail. If you have the resources, get a lawyer involved. That does make correctional services get a bit more anxious and perhaps do their job a bit better. I don't even think there's NGOs that people can turn to for assistance when it comes to parole issues. And start asking your political representatives to ask questions in Parliament about when things are changing.
Yeah. Anyone you're concerned about potentially coming up for parole imminently?
Oof. Oh, you know what, there's, you know, not that I am... I have been thinking, if I'm calculating from when I was in the police, there should be a lot of guys,
serial
rapists and other people who would be coming up for parole.
You guys were busy 20 years ago.
That we don't know about. So, but every day people are being paroled. So, you know, we should be concerned about this process all the time, right now and on in the future, because there's people we don't know about who've done horrific things that are being considered for parole as we speak. So,
there's the means to do it easily. All it requires is the will. The problem is the list of things to fix in SA is getting longer and longer. So, you know, where does this one get prioritized on that list under things like electricity and water? Gerard, thank you so much as always. Folks, thanks for listening to the podcast. If you have any stories regarding your interactions with the parole system. We'd love to hear them, positive and negative. If you want to just continue to indulge in local true crime, you can go back and listen to some of our previous episodes. If you're new to the podcast, we will be recording. I know I've said this before and I'm going to say it again. We are going to be recording new episodes now. I said it last year. It took us a year.
Yes, we never said necessarily when.
Exactly.
We're not saying when.
I'm not going to say when anymore.
And we're not saying how many per.
But yeah, just look out for us. We're doing our best to be more regular with this kind of thing. We do love doing the podcast. It just life kind of catches up with you, you know. If you want to kind of stay deep in local crime and all of that stuff, the Profiler Diaries, both books 1 and 2, are available. For sale online at your favorite online retailer or your favorite local bookstore. So please support Gerard and support our kind of local
local true crime stuff.
True crime
books or podcasts.
True crime community, and get your hands on that if you haven't had a read. They're both great reads. Yeah, and that's the story. Thank you so much, Gerard, as always. Subscribe to us on YouTube at youtube.com/C/ProfilerAfrica. We're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Simply search Profiler Africa. And you can follow us on Instagram at Profiler Africa. And do join our Facebook group. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back. Thank you, Gerard.
Just
see you soon, and rest easy, everybody.